I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Zone Media.
Hey everyone, Robert Evans here with Behind the Bastards, and we've got some kind of sad news today. You know, this is going to hit members of the community pretty hard. But 48 years ago, on November 10th, 1975, the SS Edmund Fitzgerald went down in Lake Superior, killing all 29 crew members on board. This is a hard time of the year for everybody here at Behind the Bastards, for all of you at home. And the only thing that makes it easier is the knowledge that both the Russian Federation and the Chinese government have recently substantially increased the sizes of their nuclear stockpile, while the United States is in the process of renovating its own nuclear weapons. And my hope, I think all of our hope, is that the leaders of our world can kind of band together in this time of conflict and sadness to finally expend the entirety of their nuclear stockpiles, detonating them over Lake Superior. You know, that's my hope. I know it's all of your hope back at home. And I really think what can carry us through this is some classic Mao era propaganda posters showing Joe Biden, Xi Jinping, and Vladimir Putin walking hand in hand, surrounded by a crowd of little kids in Red Guard uniforms, heading towards the light of a new atomic sun, while a series of mushroom clouds detonate over Lake Superior's depths. Anyway, welcome to the show, Jamie.
That's so, I mean, first of all, thank you. Thank you for that. I needed to hear it. I think we all, the image you described, and I hate that my mind went here, conjured the image of Paul Walker in the convertible next to Brian Griffin.
That's right. That's right.
That
That's
was
right.
Sort of what I was picturing. The image you described has that exact same image. Just add, yeah, just yeah. Throw someone in the back seat. Same exact shit.
Yes. That's the dream, Jamie. That's the dream. God, what a beautiful, beautiful dream.
I really think about being a member of Paul Walker's family at the time that image was circulating.
You mean from your jacuzzi filled with $100 bills? Yes.
Even so, my loved one, yeah, my dearly departed, being thrown in a convertible next to a cartoon dog who, to add insult to injury, would be resurrected within months. Yes. And like Brian the dog, Brian the dog was resurrected, I think, on the same timeline as Jesus Christ.
Yeah,
like,
more
it
or
was
less.
Like, yeah, it
very
was
very similar it, characters. Yes.
Yeah. And we can all agree that
both
Brian
have been
is
on Bill
Christ-like.
Maher's show.
They're both Maher heads, and they also, and they both are, you know, like middling authors,
yeah,
you could say.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fair to say. So, Jamie.
Yeah.
Speaking of mediocre men, how do you feel? Have you been keeping up with the story of Bastards Pod alumni Sam Bankman-Fried?
Okay, so I know the broad strokes, but as soon as the joyous news became started coming in, I knew that we were going to be doing this, and I don't know any of the particulars except for tweets of yours that have been algorithmed to the top of my feed. I'm just, I there's no one I would rather be with to let it just wash over me.
Robert, can I ask you to please share your working title for this episode? Because it's funny.
Oh, yeah. It's Sam Bankman not freed in parentheses because he is in jail.
I think it's funny.
And I think that that is far superior to Sam Bankman jailed.
Yeah.
And
No, that's not creative at all. You got to spend a lot of extra words to make it creative.
I'm not interested in other perspectives on that title. I think that you got it exactly right.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Brevity is some bullshit, as a great author once said. So, Jamie, speaking of great authors, 80% of this episode is shitting on Michael Lewis, the author of The Big Short.
Wow.
No, we're really, this is going to be a great one for the Lewis heads in the audience.
Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. This is going to
buckle up. Yeah. Now, buckle this is relevant. Lewis.
The man just said, buckle up.
Oh, yeah. Strap the fuck in
buckle
and
up,
down.
Buckle heads.
We are starting with Michael Lewis, author of The Big Short, Jamie.
I feel like when I recently saw a picture of my 3-year-old niece going to a Wiggles concert, and I just caught myself smiling in the same way. This is great.
This is great. So on January 5th, 2022, Sam Bankman-Fried sent a message to one of his many signal loops. For what it's worth, February 8th through 16th, Michael Lewis is going to be in the Bahamas profiling us. Now, if you haven't been following the story, and if Michael Lewis is not familiar to you, then you probably do remember like the most famous result of one of his novels, which is the movie The Big Short. This was based on a book Lewis wrote about a group of traders who had the foresight to predict and profit off of the 2008 financial crash. They realized that like the subprime loan business was like a bunch of hooey and they shorted it, right? Made a bunch of money while everybody else lost their jobs.
You love to see it.
You love to see it. His other best known work is probably Moneyball, which is about a baseball team manager who uses what's called sabermetrics, which without getting into it is basically being Nate Silver, but also actually running a sports team. Right.
In 2020, I started doing this bit on cursed Zoom comedy shows called the Boyfriend Criterion Collection. Uh-huh. And it's just like Blu-rays that are in your house against your living will.
Yeah.
Moneyball is very much a part of the Boyfriend Criterion Collection. No. It's right up there with Whiplash. It's like a disaster.
I must say, if you did not date the worst man you've ever dated in your entire life in 2017 that was obsessed with all things Michael Lewis, then were you really in Los Angeles?
Yeah, no. Damn. That's true. The only non-problematic,
the is,
by the
what
way
if your what if your worst boyfriend couldn't read really there
then you're the median American. And look,
I honestly don't even know who I'm talking about, like it's impossible to say.
Folks,
the
only non-problematic piece of physical media that you can have in your house as a boyfriend is an original VHS tape of Tremors. That's just the way it works. So.
I would fight with you if I didn't feel the same way. I think that is very much, that's a good sign.
Thank you. Thank you.
The more prominently displayed, the better.
To say that Michael Lewis is a famous writer or famous journalist puts it pretty lightly. He's probably the best known journalist in the country and almost certainly the wealthiest. There's not a lot of competition for that, but like he's definitely in the running. He's what you'd call an access journalist. He is somebody whose stories come from his ability to get close to his subjects and just kind of exist with them during a crucial period of time as a fly on the wall. There's a number of ways to do this. There are a couple of like big Trump administration books written by journalists who basically just got to sit around Trump and his White House while things went insane. The route that Lewis takes is to befriend the people that he's writing about, right? He is this guy, and people who know him will say he just kind of makes people comfortable around him. He is a guy that you want to have at a party. He's pleasant company. Enough people have said this that I assume it's true based on just like how he does his stories. He is good at putting folks at ease and they don't mind him being around, and that's how he gets a lot of his stories. As a general rule, if you are in the position that Sam Bankman-Fried and his friends were in circa 2022, running a massive financial shell game, you would be hesitant
I think we can all agree based on all the information we had.
Kings.
Talk about a game of 4D chess.
Yeah. The last guy you might want hanging around your office is a dude who could literally, like Michael Lewis, could literally in like the space of a phone call get articles greenlit in every newspaper in the country, right? He just is, he has that kind of pull. He is that reliable a seller for his stories. Like nobody would not want to take a story that he had. So you would want to be cautious. You would think you'd want to be cautious about letting this guy into your house. Yeah. But there's a reason why they said yes when he reached out to SBF, and it's that Michael Lewis's reputation among people in the finance industry was not, oh, he wrote this book that's critical of us. Oh, he's this guy who exposes the dirt of the finance industry. It's, this is a guy who can make you into a celebrity. And in early 2022, that was the entire vision of everyone like connected business-wise to Sam Bankman-Fried, was we need to turn this guy into a celebrity who's constantly everywhere to raise the profile of this exchange, right? They spent something like $1 billion on a variety of different corporate and celebrity endorsements. Of the $9 billion that was missing, about $1 billion went towards shit to boost FTX and to boost Sam's profile, right?
The where's the, you got to spend money to make money as the aphorism goes.
I guess so.
You got to spend $10 billion to make nothing, to and go to jail. You have to famously spend $10 billion to go to jail, is what I'm saying.
To go to forever prison, Jamie. Let's be honest about this.
He's going to, I for every time I've seen Forever Prison, very often from you, I hear it in the cadence of the Forever Purge trailer. You're like, it's the Forever Prison.
Yeah, that is where he's going. And that's, you know, again, everyone has kind of cut ties. Everyone legitimate has cut ties with not just Sam, but like crypto in general in the wake of Sam's collapse. But there was about a year and a half period where like every bank was looking into it. Every tech company was putting shit on the blockchain. The last kind of holdout, and the reason why Sam put so much money into this, was politicians, right? There were a few who would, but like most people who were in politics would not even take donations directly from crypto, right? You had to launder that shit. And Sam was looking to buy himself a sizable chunk of Congress so that he could make sure that regulations on crypto favored his company specifically, which is why he did stuff like, you know, he spent tens of millions of dollars getting Tom Brady and Gisele Bündchen to like pretend to be his friends. He sat down next to Bill Clinton on fucking stage in a very cringy interview. He paid Larry David to make a Super Bowl ad. But all of that, the potential all of that had to legitimize him, paled in comparison to having the Big Short dude treat you like a financial genius, right? If Michael Lewis treats you like Michael Burry, who's one of the characters from The Big Short who became a big name after Lewis wrote this book, if he's like, this guy is that kind of financial genius, then everybody's going to start taking your calls, even people who like have been hiding from crypto because they don't, they're worried that what happened would happen, right? That you'd get 10 million in donations and have to pay them back because it turned out that it was a con man. You know,
there's a note of it that it almost reminds me it when like Errol Morris like profiled and worked for Elizabeth Holmes. You're just like, it's that level of profile versus L.
Yes, this turns you into somebody who's like, who can be taken seriously, because that's what who Lewis is, right? He's that, he is that big a deal. I'm not like puffing him up. He doesn't need it, right?
No, he got people to care about Moneyball, the most the most boring ass thing I've ever heard about in my life.
Well, and that's the thing. He is one of these guys. He's maybe the main character of this episode. I wouldn't call him quite a bastard. But one of the things you have to give him is he is legitimately a very good writer. There's no other way you get people to give a shit about Moneyball. He's like, I read his whole Sam Bankman-Fried book. I think it's bullshit, but I didn't get bored at any point. He knows how to pace a piece of writing, you know? So he decides to come knocking. Sam is immediately on board. All of their PR people are on board. Not everyone at FTX is on board. Carolyn Edison, who is his on-again, off-again girlfriend who testified against him repeatedly, she is running Alameda, which is the company that bankrupts everything that he is illegally funneling consumer deposits into. She is basically like the, and she does not like the idea of having Michael Lewis around. Now, she can't really confront Sam Bankman-Fried when she has a bad idea. Nobody can. So she just kind of hedges it and says in the Signal chat, makes sense. I feel like my instincts are more towards under the radar, but I might just be irrationally biased towards that in general. And then like an emoji of a face sticking its tongue out. And Sam That's replies, same, except exactly the opposite.
That great. Like, you know, you're down bad if you're asking Sam Bankman-Fried to make sense.
Yeah.
That's challenging. Oh, God. That's such, I mean, I don't know. I know we've talked about her in the past, but that, yeah. Like, what a mess. What a nightmare.
She's in a rough situation, and we'll talk a lot about how he treats her in this. But Will McCaskill is also in that Signal chat. And Will is basically the founder. He's not, like, literally the founder, but he is the founder of what is most commonly talked about as the effective altruism movement, and definitely its figurehead, right? He is the big guy. He's this Oxford professor who he pills Sam Bankman-Fried on the idea. And his response is kind of, I think, part of why this winds up going down. He says, I think either approach is reasonable, should just be a deliberate, coordinated plan. But if a whole bunch of attention is going to be on FTX, Sam, and EA, whatever happens, then getting ahead of the game and controlling the narrative is necessary. Yup, responded Sam. And they did it. Michael Lewis spends like a year with this guy. Like, he spends a lot of time around them. Everyone's very excited because what happened last year is Sam's world collapses and he gets charged with like 7 felonies. And then right afterwards, Michael Lewis is like, by the way, I've been basically living with him for a year. And everyone's like, oh, shit, this could be pretty good. Because, like, this guy can write. He's been written about a financial collapse before. He's got front seat tickets to this whole thing. And then the book comes out. And unfortunately for Lewis, the book comes out. He times the release right for when the court case starts. So we get all of this right alongside his book. We get all of these Signal texts and stuff that were not in his book. And kind of the overwhelming thing that you see when you compare what comes out in the court case, what comes out in the testimony of his friends to the text of Lewis's book is that, like, oh, Michael got kind of fucking conned by this dude. Right.
Oh,
yeah. Like, he fell for it. Yeah.
And I mean, it speaks to the level of confidence one would have to have in their own reporting to time it with the trial, because if you had even a remote feeling that you had gotten it wrong, I would be like, release it a year after the trial, like bury it.
And that's the thing. I can see if you're just some journalist and this is your first book, or you just don't have, you're not like a huge hit. So like you are your publisher has a lot of power and they're like, we want this to drop when the case does, because that's when it'll sell best. Mm-hmm. I get that you might not have the suction necessary to move it. Michael Lewis can say, we are putting this out this day. And like, suck my dick, I'm Michael Lewis, it'll make you money, right? Mm-hmm. And he doesn't, which suggests he has the same kind of hubris that Sam Bankman-Fried did in a lot of ways.
Bummer.
So to give you an example of how emotionally involved Lewis is in this case, there's a good write-up on the court case by a journalist who was there during the trial, which was not filmed, writing for Jacobin. And this is how they describe the devastating cross-examination of Bankman-Fried, who, again, chose to take the stand in his own defense, despite every expert saying, absolutely never do this. Quote, across the aisle from me, in the section reserved for friends and family, I could see Sam's parents growing increasingly agitated, his mom visibly shaking. 2 rows behind them, I couldn't help but notice author Michael Lewis leaning forward, arms draped over the bench in front of him, with his head down between his arms.
Nobody expects Michael Lewis in the courtroom.
Yeah. They're and I do actually have, I don't think they're very good people, but I have sympathy for Sam's parents. This is like a nightmare to know that your kid is going to forever prison for, even if it's totally their fault. Michael Lewis just got conned.
my empathy only goes so far, but also like, what a scene. What a fucking scene.
Absolutely phenomenal. Yeah.
Terrific. Yeah.
Can't wait for Jonah Hill to star as Sam Bankman-Fried in the movie based on this.
No, I really don't want
that. There's no one I want to see play him in a movie. Just do him like Maris in Frasier. Have him always be off screen.
That would be, that makes me so happy. I love a good, like the parents and Charlie Brown, Heather Sinclair of Degrassi. I could go on.
And fuck it, you know what? Cast David Hyde Pierce as Michael Lewis. Then we got a movie. Then we got a fucking film.
Then we got, I mean, if this whole ordeal results in David Hyde Pierce winning an Oscar for a bad
movie? Absolutely. That's 100%.
There's no way this movie is good. There's no way it's good.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and it's possible that Adam McKay, in an effort to course correct
on
having
Adam
endorsed,
McKay on. Sure.
Yeah, Adam he McKay, he's this. Like, he absolutely could. And he would need to course correct on the Michael Lewis in the first place for having directed The Big Short. It's a great move for everyone.
We could make
I'm everyone's agent in this situation.
You're going to be rich, Jamie.
I'm going to be fucking rich.
Yeah. In interviews he gave after the book came out and the trial started, Lewis framed his book Going Infinite about Sam Bankman-Fried as a letter to the jury, which is like kind of nonsense, because obviously the jury is never allowed to read a book about the guy that they're going on a trial about. And the judge specifically instructed them not to. There's an interview with 60 Minutes, which is really something. We will hear some clips from it later. But in that interview, Lewis explained, I mean, there's going to be this trial and the lawyers are going to tell two stories. And so there's a story war going on in the courtroom. And I think neither one of those stories is as good as the one I have. And like, I on one hand, yes, of course you're right, because you're a better writer than any lawyer is going to be. But on the other hand, this isn't a story. It's just a question of what happened, Michael Lewis. And
good
what happened is massive
Lord.
Fraud. And you don't put that in your book.
I can be of many minds about characterizing it as a story war, because that is like just how history is written. And it's kind of almost refreshing to hear someone refer it to as like, well, whoever could write the better story, that's will end up having the historical precedent. But interesting that it would be said out loud in that way.
Yeah. And again, I want to reiterate, while Michael is the main character here, he's not a bastard. He's not someone whose like impact on the world has been monstrous. As far as I've ever heard, he's a reasonably nice person. We'll definitely get him being mean at a couple of points here, but it's nothing that I would like call someone that like one of history's greatest monster over. But this is Bankman-Fried is a bastard. And so I think talking about the way in which he kind of has Lewis wrapped around his finger and the degree to which Lewis tortures his own logic and prose in order to ignore that is just fascinating. So with that in mind, let's start with a little bit more of Michael's backstory, because that is important to understand why he falls for this. Michael Monroe Lewis was born on October 15th, 1960 in New Orleans. Now, from the beginning, his life was about as far from working class as you get. And to his credit, Lewis does not deny this whenever he's asked.
That's the only thing you can do, I guess.
Yeah, you've got to be open about it. Here's him talking to The Guardian. Lewis's family sat at the very top of the WASP aristocracy in New Orleans. I was so inside, he told me. I was literally trained how to sit on a throne when I was 15 years old, because I was crowned the king of the carnival ball, an organization that didn't allow black people, didn't allow Jews. I would go from baseball practice to scepter waving lessons. I was born into that world. Being an insider in New Orleans made him feel like an outsider everywhere else, and not always to his disadvantage. And first off, wow. That's quite a backstory.
Thank you, King. Thank you, King.
I do think I want to point out something here, which is where I don't think he's obfuscating, but I think he's missing something about his own, what his background has done for him. Because I'm not going to question him when he says it made him feel like an outsider. But I think it's very clear that this is a guy whose work is defined by his ability to make himself into an insider. And I think that's a big part of why he's able to do that is he grows up in the middle of wealth and power, right? Where it's the air that he breathes. And you don't notice this if, like, you grow up working class and don't know any super rich people. But when you meet some people who were born crazy rich, you note that, like, a lot of them have this way of making themselves feel like they belong anywhere, right? It's why they can get away with so much. Like, even if they're totally out of their depth, there's this kind of expectation you get when you grow up hyper rich that the world is going to show you a degree of deference. When you know people who have family fortunes behind them, you know what I'm talking about, right? Like, it's the reason they are never going to get, like, carded to see if they're a member of a place that's members only, right? Because they have that way about them. And I think that's part
of
like
how
Lewis...
It is like an imperceptible thing. Well, yeah. And I do think that there is... I mean, and it sounds like what you're getting at is, like, there is if you can get someone who grew up in those circumstances on the side of fucking decency, there is a huge value to having someone like that who knows how to navigate those spaces on your side. But if they're but also, you know, to an extent, and a liability, because you never know, you know. So I'm curious what endears him to our Sam.
Yeah, we'll get to that. So he goes to Princeton University and he graduates cum laude, which means pretty good grades, in 1982. His senior thesis is on Donatello, a prominent Ninja Turtle. And when he's in college, he's a member of Princeton's Ivy Club, which is the oldest eating club in the school. Now, if you're not a blue blood, you probably are like, what the fuck is an eating club? These are private dining halls that are also kind of social clubs where upperclassmen go to get nicer food. There's like 9 of them, I think, on campus.
Robert.
And Ivy Club is the oldest.
At Princeton or like everywhere?
Princeton. Princeton. There's other colleges. Like, fancy boy schools have these. I think,
Robert,
right?
This is full cunt. The Ivy Club.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, eating club. The like eating club to me is like drive-through Taco Bell 1:30 a.m.
Yeah.
Starving.
Yeah.
Wow. Eating club. What are they eating?
Sophie, you said this is full cunt, but it did not admit women until 1991.
The audacity to not let a woman go full cunt?
Something that cunty, it just doesn't make sense.
And it's also very funny that, like, or not funny, but it's noteworthy in this interview, it talks about how he was at the Ivy Club, right? When he talks about, you know, his upbringing, he's like, yeah, this contest I was in, you couldn't be in this club if you were like black or Jewish. He doesn't mention that the Ivy Club doesn't admit women. I think that is maybe interesting. It's also worth noting that the Ivy Club, F. Scott Fitzgerald writes about the Ivy Club and calls it Scott Fitzgerald calls it detached and breathlessly aristocratic. And if F. Scott Fitzgerald says that about your blue blood club, like, my God.
I love that. Wow. Yeah. What a treat. Mm-hmm. What a treat. If F. Scott Fitzgerald is the one experiencing like moral clarity about your weird sandwich group. That's challenging.
Now, while Lewis had a passion for art history, he had a bigger passion in life, and it's stacking motherfucking paper. So he goes to the London School of Economics next and eventually joins the bond desk at Salomon Brothers. He's in like the London branch of the Salomon Brothers. No. He's just making dollar bills, y'all.
Robert, dollar bills time is happening now for us as well.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of dollar bills, buy some of these products and we will get dollar bills. The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Constantly changing challenges like money sprees or treasure hunts that keep it fresh with new wild minigames. Timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums, delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches, unique playing pieces, and so much more. The verdict is in with Monopoly Go. There's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now for free on the App Store and Google Play.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes
I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I have a request for the listeners, which is not something that I don't ask mm-hmm. anything of our listeners. Just that they're happy. But if somebody could please make a dating profile for Michael Lewis as an art graphic, please for me.
Oh man, okay, that's good. You've got two different requests this week, listeners. One is that propaganda poster. And the other is Michael Lewis dating profile. So Lewis is, you know, an investment banker for just a few years. Actually, you know who he reminds me of?
Oh, okay. Your toes in it, then that kind of doesn't count. It's like the tip of financial crime.
He's in there. At 87, the market crashes and he makes a pivot away from like doing that as a job. And he writes a book called Liar's Poker about the investment, you know, being the stockbroker, that kind of life that makes a shitload of money, right? We'll talk about it in a second, but like, he reminds me in this trajectory. Do you know anything about Michael Crichton?
I mean, peaks and valleys. I had no attachment to him, but I know many who do. And like, the back half of Michael Crichton, pretty fucking brutal.
Yeah, pretty brutal. I'm not talking about like his actual career as a writer as much as Crichton goes to Harvard Medical School and becomes a doctor. Most people I don't think actually know this. But like he was an actual MD, but he doesn't really do the job. Like he gets his MD and then he quits to write books, like some of which have a medical, like he's the creator of ER, and he gets criticized by doctors who are like,
the creator of ER?
Yeah. Michael Crichton created ER. Yes.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I thought you were talking about Michael Lewis. Yes. I knew Michael
but
Crichton.
They have they have a similar kind of trajectory where they go to school for this thing. They do like a teeny amount of it, just dip their toes in, and then they get famous writing these books that are inspired by it. Right. I just find that interesting. So to give you a further idea of Lewis's family background, Liar's Poker, which is semi-autobiographical, revolves around a scene where Michael Lewis is invited to a banquet hosted by the Queen Mother while he's working in London. He gets a seat there because of his cousin, Baroness Linda von Stauffenberg, and she seats him next to the manager of Salomon Brothers, which is how he gets his job.
Word salad. Salad.
Crabs don't have bluer blood than this man. Like that is the bluest you fucking get.
If your cousin's a baroness and you're in your like late 20s, what?
If you know a baroness, you are like
that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So Lewis's depiction of Wall Street guys from Liar's Poker on, because he writes a few books about Wall Street types because he knows them, right? Yeah. It's generally noted as not being flattering, but I think that's by people who like have a very naive view of what's unflattering, because his Wall Street guys, they curse a lot. They use phrases like big swinging dick. They're like kind of gross, but in a way that's glamorous, right?
Like, I feel like it's like the Glengarry Glen Ross.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
talking shit. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It is a kind of thing where you could say he's not glamorizing it, but he's absolutely making it look a way that makes more greedy young men want to become stock traders. And to extend the Michael Crichton comparison, Liar's Poker is generally agreed to have had a similar impact on its industry to how Jurassic Park influenced paleontology by like bringing a shitload of people in.
Wow. That's really interesting to me because I don't know. I have not read Liar's Poker, to be honest. I have not read any of his books. I have seen some of the adaptations in movies of his books. But But yeah, in terms of like anytime someone writes something about Wall Street, like you have to be so fucking careful. And yeah. also, even if you are extremely fucking careful, it will still bring in the wrong people yeah. who refuse to see the point. Like they're like Wolf of Wall Street is one of my favorite movies, hands down. I think
it's great. It's an amazing satire. Yeah.
But it still like brought people in on the wrong. Yes. Like, fuck it, because brain dead people are going to be brain dead people.
This is, we're going in a more serious direction, but if you've read Slaughterhouse-Five, in the opening of it, Vonnegut talks about how when he said, I'm going to write my war book, his mm-hmm. wife was like, don't do it. There's no way to do it without making it look cool. Like, no one has yeah. ever managed to not do it in a way that makes young men think it's cool. And she was right, like, for the record. Like,
yeah.
That's one of the problems with even anti-war war fiction is it always makes it look cool because mm-hmm. it's cool, right? That doesn't mean it's good. It's like Joe Camel is cool. He still killed 100 million people.
Joe Camel gave my father lung cancer.
Yeah.
And I
yeah.
stand by that. And to conjure a similar image, mm-hmm. Joe Camel, there's an image that I saw when I worked in the Playboy archives of Joe Camel, an illustrated, gorgeous, like, painting, mm-hmm. essentially, of Joe Camel in a convertible with smoking hot human women.
Hell yeah.
With big old titties. And you're like, no wonder. This yeah, of advertisement course. Of course. Killed people. This yeah. advertisement killed people. Being like, this, you could be this ugly ass camel with women with huge naturals.
Yeah.
Like, it just
like you can add up all the German generals on the Eastern Front and they didn't kill as many people as that ad.
truly. Like, and it's a beautiful piece of artwork, but like, let's be fucking honest.
Yeah. So today, Lewis merely acknowledges that the psychos he wrote about in Liar's Poker were more fun on the page than they were in person. This can be, if this is your first book and you write it in 1982 and you realize later, oh, this actually might have made the problem worse. That's not a thing you have any moral culpability for. That's just like writing a thing with good intentions and it turns out badly.
Sure.
But this does become a problem, and one that we can critique as partly a moral problem when it becomes part of a pattern. And it is a pattern with Michael Lewis. The Big Short is obviously not a Wall Street puff piece, but it became beloved by exactly the same people you might assume it was trying to criticize. In that Guardian article I've quoted from, there's a story about Michael Lewis attends this big New York party, and he's like warned ahead of time that it's going to be full of bankers and other finance guys. And he's like, oh, I don't know if they're going to like me, because he had just not only was The Big Short out, but he just published an article at a major publication attacking Wall Street bigwigs as being greedy idiots, like saying it in very unsparing terms. And okay. one of Lewis's friends later said, quote, but all these former heads of investment banks, all these current bankers, they ran, not walked, to the office just to meet him. One hedge fund manager walked in with 15 copies of Lewis's books. Michael signed them all. And again, if you are a journalist, that's a bad sign.
Yeah. What is your take on that? I mean, like, what is the game of chess that I'm not seeing here?
I mean, I think it's just that he makes this look sexy. And it's if he writes about you, a big part of this is that while he's maybe negative about greed within the overall finance industry, he cannot write about a person without making them look cool. Because he has to like them to write about them, right? All these guys in The Big Short, you could say, profited off of a lot of misery. Now, they didn't cause it. They didn't start this subprime loan thing. But they profited off of a lot of misery. And that's at least kind of grimy. But Lewis likes these guys. And he turns them into okay. celebrities because of how good he is at writing about them and making you see what's likable in them, right? And
right.
so at this point, because of how often this has happened, he is aware that his books are PR for their subjects. He has a habit now of connecting people he writes about in his books to his PR manager so that they can set up speaking tours for them, right? Because he knows mm-hmm. if I put you in a book, that's going to be a big business for you. You're going to be in demand. Yeah, and this is part as a result of him. He can't really be critical about the individuals, right? And this is mm-hmm. this is another quote from that Guardian article. The obverse of Lewis's approach is that he doesn't write about people he can't befriend or about stories that might cost him relationships. Among the few projects he has abandoned is a biography of George Soros, who was so unhappy with Lewis's portrayal of him as a financier rather than an intellectual in a magazine profile that he refused to cooperate. Another is a book about New Orleans, which would have demanded a level of honesty about the city's society and about his family's place in it that might have hurt his parents. He said, "I adore my parents. I couldn't write that part while they're alive." And, you know, again, none of this is like unforgivable, but if you're admitting that as a journalist, what aren't you able to admit? And I think in this case, it's that right. He is not able to look at Sam Bankman-Fried honestly because he found himself taken in by the kid's shtick.
Well, that's what I feel like is one of the complicating factors of, and I don't say this in a way to seem like it's like an unsolvable puzzle, but it's like Michael Lewis writes, it seems like, you know, largely accurate, you know, pieces of journalism.
We'll talk about that.
Yeah. So far, right, as someone who's never read his work, but they're also inherently commercial because I feel like there's a journalistic value to explaining why someone is appealing, but there's also an even more commercial value to explaining why someone is appealing because that makes it, you know, that sells books, that sells movie deals, that sells all this shit.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's also part of why his stuff is successful in a commercial sense is that is this other fact that, like, it's always kind of uplifting, right? Again, The Big Short, the whole collapse of the financial industry is dark, but stuff goes well for these characters that you've come to like, right? Mm-hmm. And Lewis himself has kind of admitted he can't really end on a not upbeat note. He has a lot of trouble with it. He said, quote, "Once you identify yourself as happy, you're always looking for happiness. And when things come along to grate on that happiness, you find ways to deflect them. You can force the narrative." And I think what he doesn't say there, but what is explains his Sam Bankman-Fried book is that once you get in the habit of writing about like these geniuses who are hidden in the middle of systems, right, and see more than everybody else, once you start doing that, you see anybody you start focusing on as that kind of genius, even when they're not. And that's what's happened with Michael here. So, yeah.
Mess. Yeah. And it's like, you know, ultimately, we 9 times out of 10, the person wearing like fucking X-ray glasses is wearing a pair of fucking IMAX glasses to go see Oppenheimer. Like,
exactly.
It's just embarrassing.
Exactly. It's just embarrassing. And yeah, so I think the best example of this before we get into Sam Bankman-Fried prior in Lewis's history is a book called The Blind Side, which was published in 2006. Now, The Blind Side, like a lot of Lewis stories, there's a macro and a micro narrative. The macro narrative is he's talking about the explosive growth in the importance of the left tackle in football. This is an offensive lineman whose job is basically to make sure the quarterback doesn't get maimed. The micro story, which contains the emotional heart of the book and is the core of the narrative, is the tale of a guy named Michael Oher, who was he was placed in foster care at age 7 because his mother suffered from addiction. His dad was generally in prison. His dad dies while he's, I think, in high school. Or was dealt a pretty tough hand in life, but he's also 6'6" and very fast, right? So he is someone who like shows an aptitude for football. As a result of this, he's kind of coaxed through getting into a private school, and he gets literally adopted by this rich white family. Oher's a black man, black child at this time, and they make it their business to coach him and coax him in through getting through the academics so that he can be in the NCAA in college, so that he can get an NFL contract, right?
So I'll be perfectly honest. Before you told me that Michael Lewis was a main character, I did not know that he wrote The Blind Side.
Oh, yes, he did, because this becomes a movie that's huge, right?
And I am very well acquainted with the ensuing nasty fucking cultural narrative associated with the movie, but I didn't realize that it was a book. I knew Liar's Poker, Moneyball, and The Big Short. Holy fuck.
Also, Robert, I just want to fact check real quick. He wasn't adopted by them.
We're getting to that.
Okay.
That was the narrative in The Blind Side, right?
Right. Okay.
That they have basically adopted this guy. Yes, you are correct, okay. Sophie, but I'm building to that.
Okay. So I don't know why I didn't know that. And also like, who didn't want me to know that Michael Lewis wrote The Blind Side, a book that is famously bullshit.
Yeah. So this family adopts Orr, and they effectively adopt him, is I think generally how it's framed. And they help him get through high school, get into a college, and kind of like help usher him into this NFL career where he makes a significant amount of money, obviously. And I'm going to quote from the LA Times here. The administration at his high school accepts him, although he can barely read. He secures a full-time tutor. When his grade point average still proves too low for the NCAA, his adoptive father, a canny former college basketball standout named Sean Tuohy, manages to find a crucial loophole. He has Orr tested to prove that he's learning disabled, then has him take numerous easy online courses. Lewis treats these measures as ingenious. We are meant to cheer the fact that Orr has gamed the educational process. And this is this is from the book. Leanne, who's the wife of Sean, was now making it her personal responsibility to introduce him to the most basic facts of life, the sort of thing any normal person would have learned by osmosis. Every day I try to make sure he knows something he doesn't know, she said. If you ask him, where should I shop for a girl to impress her? He'll tell you Tiffany's. If I go, I'll go through the whole golf game. He can tell you what six under is and what's a birdie and what's par. I love that those are her two examples of basic knowledge.
This is Sandra Bullock's Oscar. This is Sandra Bullock's Oscar flapping its nasty little mouth. Yeah. Okay.
Two things every boy needs to know: where to buy jewelry and how to golf works. Really says a lot about her socioeconomic status, right? Not like, here's how you pay your taxes. Not like, you know, literally anything else. Like, here's how you cook eggs. But no, fucking golf and Tiffany's.
Well, yeah, and so, also, like, I mean, to state the obvious, like, conflating that with, like, this is what normal people do.
This is normal,
like,
basic
life advice.
You could
write a fucking doctoral thesis, like, in the ways that is,
okay,
like,
great.
Bullshit.
Yeah. So we can all see the potential abusive issue with a wealthy white family adopting a teenaged black boy to coach him into launching a pro football career, right? Just if you think about all of the head injuries and shit involved, there's a lot that's problematic here.
Yeah.
Lewis does quote Leanne at one point as saying, with me and Sean, I can see him thinking, if they found me lying in a gutter and I was going to be flipping burgers at McDonald's, would they really have had an interest at me? But the book is ultimately positive and uplifting. We're left thinking how nice it is that these people help this kid out. The LA Times note that Lewis seems to be, like, amused at these rich people cheating the system to usher this kid into a dangerous job without, like, educating him. So the nice parts of the story ended earlier this year when a now retired Orr filed a lawsuit in a Tennessee court alleging that the Tuohys never adopted him and instead created a conservatorship. Tuohys, I don't care. Fuck them. And instead created a conservatorship and used it to take his money, right? The Tuohys or whatever the fuck deny doing this.
It's
they call
also
his claims-
Leanne.
I'm sorry. I think it's pronounced the peepees.
I don't care.
The
dick bags deny this. And again, I'm not being a non-biased journalist here, but fuck it.
No. Robert, it's actually Dickmans. It's Dickmans.
The Dickmans. They call his claims hateful and absurd. Michael Lewis has defended the Tuohys by saying that they only earned a few $100,000 off of The Blind Side, the book and the movie that was made off of it. He's like, they didn't make millions. They only made a few $100,000. Now, Lewis also does, and I'll give him this, he also admits right after saying that the Tuohy's biological daughter is married to the son of the main investor in the film, which might suggest that the family made a lot more money off of it, right? Blind Side makes $500 million and a $35 million budget. In his
what happens
own way,
to Michael Lewis in this kind
Michael
of
Michael Lewis is super rich and
they,
always
they
will
really,
be.
There's been
buried
so,
some leads
there's
there.
Been so many articles about this. Like,
it is there's
everywhere.
Some shady shit.
That's
that
the
went
first
down
time
this.
I'm hearing about the daughter's marriage, because I read a fair amount about that case.
Uh-huh. Fun stuff. So in his own 2011 book, Orr, like, expresses issues with the movie based off of Lewis's book. Primarily, there's this part where, like, the Tuohys are teaching him how to play football. And he's like, I knew football before I met them. I'm a teenager in America. Like, what are you fucking talking about? There are other problematic moments in the book. And this is from The Guardian again. Lewis calls Orr Big Mike throughout it, despite the fact that Orr is open about hating that nickname. He also tells this guy's story almost exclusively through the words of other people talking about him, even though he had access to Orr. Lewis justifies this by saying that Orr was not a strong voice on his life. Yeah, this guy's not good at talking about himself. I'm just going to listen to everyone else about him.
I'm out. Yeah. I think
what's really going on here is that Poer is a black kid from a desperate poverty background, right? And Lewis cannot identify or get inside of his head because that is nothing even that even resembles the Michael Lewis story.
It feels like a very privileged, dark take on like, well, who do I consider to be a credible voice? Can I get 20 white people who barely know this guy?
Yeah, who just met this kid to profit off him?
To speak to him better than he can speak to his own life? Yeah. Because that's who I trust is white people. That's so fucking gross. So
he doesn't try to get inside Ower's head, and he just focuses most of the narrative on the Twoies, who Lewis understands, this is the final shoe, he understands them for a very good reason. And I'm going to quote from the LA Times here. As I tore through the book, I kept wondering how Lewis got such remarkable access to the Twoies. And I also wondered, why does he take such an uncritical view of their role? The author's note at the end provides the obvious explanation, stating that Lewis is a friend of Sean Twoies and that they had been longtime classmates at the same New Orleans school.
No. How is it even ethical to take this fucking story on if you have...
There's only one kind of ethics that I care about, Jamie, and it's dollar fucking bills.
Well, Jamie, as you know, things could be unethical but still be legal.
Legal. That's how he lives his life.
Lives his life. I mean, truly, what a gift that we have a force of evil in the world, certainly. Yeah. But I am grateful that he gave us that one thing, just the way of describing juvenile lawless capitalists.
Yeah, it's so funny. Yeah. Now, one thing I have started to notice watching some of the more recent and critical interviews with Lewis after the SBF book is that while he's generally a pretty friendly seeming guy, he starts to get really angry the instant you question him on anything regarding one of his stories. And you see this in this story, in the Ower story, because Ower's former coach comes out and like defends the Twohees or whatever. Once the lawsuit goes out, he's like, you know, I don't think they took advantage of him, basically. And Ower calls it brave.
In my professional, unbiased opinion, fuck you. Yeah.
Lewis calls the coach brave for doing this and basically says he's taking a stand against cancel culture. And then here's The Guardian again. Lewis recalled Ower as a shy young boy and found it hard to square that memory with the Ower behind the lawsuit. What we're watching is a change of behavior, he told me. This is what happens to football players who get hit in the head. They run into problems with violence and aggression. It wouldn't surprise him, Lewis said, if we were seeing some confluence of Ower's history in football with other campaigns that stoke claims in lawsuits like his. Perhaps some lawyer of Ower's figured the time was ripe to sue the Twohees, Lewis speculated. Or perhaps Ower realized that people would get behind him if he makes these accusations. That's just a poor head injured boy.
They're like, no, the perceived exploitation and racism you experienced was the result of CTE.
It's fucking disgusting. Wild, right? That's gross as hell.
Oh, now, I hate Jamie. Him. Wow. I just thought he was the guy who wrote Moneyball. I thought that was the harmony.
That is
what
I was thinking, too. Now, so here I want you to keep in mind how he wrote about his former subject, Ower. Now, here is him talking in a 60 Minutes interview about Sam Bankman-Fried, the now convicted former billionaire. And I really want to emphasize the contrast between how he writes about these two different people who are subjects of his books. Mm-hmm.
The story of Sam's life is people not understanding him, misreading him. He's so different. He's so unusual. I mean, I think in a funny way that the reason I have such a compelling story is I have a character that I do come to know and that the reader comes to know that the world still doesn't know.
Now, that is not the case. Sam Bankman-Fried is exactly the person he appears to be on the surface, right? He is a guy who committed a bunch of financial crimes and didn't get away with it because he was too lazy and undisciplined to do it the smart way, right?
And
that's all that's going on.
I mean, this is like, this is a bummer. This is like a case study in a journalist's biases coming out in their work.
It's so obvious.
Yeah.
Now, no story better illustrates this part of the story than how Lewis wound up writing Going Infinite in the first place. In 2014, Lewis published a book called Flash Boys, which is a book about Brad Katsuyama and a small group of rebel Wall Street investors who form IEX, which is like a stock exchange that's supposed to, the idea is we want to protect investors from the unfair advantages that these high frequency trading firms have on traditional exchanges due to like a whole bunch of shit, but largely access to a special fiber optic cable. And with most Lewis books, there's a lot of insiders that will criticize him for getting some details wrong here and glossing over some issues that don't conform to his narrative. There's like a market crash that's largely like mitigated by some of these firms that he's criticizing, but I don't know enough about that to want to get into it. What's important is that Katsuyama and his book of rogue traders are depicted semi-heroically, as if they're kind of fighting against this rigged financial system, which, you know, the financial system's rigged. I don't know about his characterization of them, but the book is a hit and it makes Katsuyama and his crew celebrities within the finance world. So Katsuyama reaches out to Lewis when he is considering an institutional investment in FTX. He's like, we're considering getting into crypto through these guys, putting a lot of money on their exchange. Would you look into this guy for me? Right. Mm-hmm. And this is what Lewis says. Lewis like basically goes in there and like talks to Sam Bankman-Fried. And he's so impressed that he quotes himself as telling Katsuyama, do whatever he wants to do. What could possibly go wrong? Right. That's which bad bet. Katsuyama
really,
does wind up putting money in.
You couldn't choose a worse person to ask what could go wrong with.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm going to continue from The Guardian here.
Okay.
He did find himself intrigued in particular by effective altruism, the movement to which Bankman-Fried subscribed. Effective altruists believe in giving away most of what they make to do the most good in the world. Some of them commit to earning as much as possible so as to donate more to their chosen beneficiaries. Having spent so long on Wall Street, Lewis wasn't used to meeting a wealthy young man who claimed to have no interest in wealth. Unusually for Lewis, he couldn't figure Bankman-Fried out. Michael just said, "This kid is the richest and most interesting young person I've ever met."
Oh
he
my
didn't
God.
Claim to understand all the deep recesses of Bankman-Fried's mind, but he knew it was a great story. And this was before the shit hit the fan.
So
that's
this
one of his friends
like,
talking. Yeah.
And also, it takes someone who grew up in that environment to not have alarm bells going off in their mind when they hear, oh, I, as someone who has never not had money, don't really care about money. You're like, well, yeah, no shit. You've never not had it. You would really care if you never. That reminds me of, this is like, I think about this easily once a week. It happened over 10 years ago. My freshman year of college, it was my first time really encountering people who like grew up with like money, you know, and there was this guy on my floor and one night everyone was hanging out and he like, put a, this is the era, this is the early 2010s. He put a skinny scarf around my neck because it was cold. And he was like, you can have that. And it smelled and I didn't want it. But he's like, you can have that. And I was like, oh, don't you like want it back? And he's like, no, I don't care about my material possessions. And
great.
I think about that all the time because he could just get 9,000 scarves. He could just get 9,000 scarves. But that was like, but I feel like that is so much of what effective altruism is. It's just a fundamental, like, not understanding how the world works.
Yeah, it's a bunch of rich kids who are talking through like fucking philosophy 101 level shit and think and so impressed by everyone else's answers to like dumb logic puzzles because they've never studied enough humanities to know that like, man, people have been talking about this shit for thousands of years and all of their takes are better than yours. Like, anyway, we're not getting into that as much right now. We are about to get into the ads. And if you really want to do some effective altruism, purchase from the sponsors of this podcast. The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Constantly changing challenges like money sprees or treasure hunts that keep it fresh with new wild minigames. Timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums, delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches, unique playing pieces, and so much more. The verdict is in with Monopoly Go. There's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now for free on the App Store and Google Play.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff.
In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with the Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elia Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow, thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So we've been talking around the book Going Infinite, which is Michael's terrible book on Sam. So I think now is probably a good time to dig into exactly how it fails. I wanted to start by introducing that contrast between Lewis's treatment of Ower and SBF first, because it puts things into perspective. Now, I think a good anecdote to start on here is one of the stories Lewis uses to introduce Sam to the reader. This is right at the start of Going Infinite, and it's about a phone call that Sam has during his billionaire era with fashion industry icon Anna Wintour before the Met Gala.
No.
Now, oh, yeah. Oh, good yeah, Jamie. Lord. This is good. So for
I'm
reference.
I'm exhausted. Because Anna Wintour is Bill Nighy's girlfriend right now, and I don't want to think poorly of Bill Nighy. That's
hard
for me.
It is
That's
tragic. My heart goes out to Bill Nighy, who I'm incapable of feeling badly about.
No, I'm here. I'm sitting my ass down and listening.
Yeah. So Anna is who Meryl Streep's character in The Devil Wears Prada is based on, right? Yeah. Like, that's who this person is.
Oh, I love when men try to explain what The Devil Wears Prada is about. Yes, all the men listening, pause and go watch The Devil Wears Prada. It is just like one
it's
of the
fun.
Greatest films of, I think, one
and
of the
books.
Greatest comedy films and books of of
it's
our
very
generation.
Good, very good movie.
Half the essays I wrote in college were based off of said book.
Really?
So, the Met Gala is an annual event. I think Vogue puts it on technically, but like it's where rich, famous, and occasionally even beautiful people wear insane outfits that cost the GDP of a small island nation, right?
Yes. And then and then a bunch of YouTubers I watch say that they looked ugly.
Yes.
It's a treat.
Yeah. It's great. It's great. Everybody makes a feast off of it. But somebody has to pay for the son of a bitch, right? And that year, Wintour wanted SBF to pay for the gala, right? And he was spending way more money on stupider shit than that. So not unreasonable that he might actually agree to do this. He had instructed at this point his publicity woman to do whatever she could to increase FTX's reputation and keep his name in the news. So not a bad way to do that, right? The Met Gala often does make the news. And when it came to his side of the job, though, he put as much work into like this call with Anna Wintour, where tens of millions of dollars are on the line, that he did to like everything else that he had a meeting about, which is no work at all, right? Lewis goes into detail about the fact that he's playing this dumb video game, like while he's on a Zoom call with her. It's the same game he's always playing. It's this video game that he winds up buying because it's made by a friend of his called Storybook Brawl.
What is it about? Tell me.
It's about
Tell
like
me,
fable characters fighting, right? Like it's a little strategy game. It's like an app game. It's not a real game.
You know how you watch those videos, and I say this with mm-hmm. with love and appreciation of like college students now playing a video game while explaining like Marxism to you.
Yes. And, like, yes.
I want that, but Sam Bankman-Fried playing that game while Anna Wintour is like, what is he up to? What is he up to?
The Jamie and I in unison when you said playing video game while talking to Anna Wintour.
Yeah.
Mouth wide open, like.
Well, it's like she could, yeah. I mean, and not even to like endorse her. I'm just like, I would be very afraid to do anything
she's
in front of
scary.
Her.
Scary. Well,
and it's,
she's
it's
the, famously scary.
She's famously scary, and he's talking about a lot of money, right? Like, it's not that he's blowing her off, because, like, I don't feel precious about Anna Wintour's time, but, like, it's that this is a big money deal, and he can't focus on it. And I would take that as just like, oh, yeah, this is a dude who has some ADHD, right? Like, that's what that is. Mm-hmm. And this is a dude who has ADHD who's part of a generation that has ADHD.
Well, no, this is a very dumb observation, but it's also clear to me that Sam Bankman-Fried has never seen The Devil Wears Prada, which I've never been less surprised at. But it's like, no. If you have no one in your life who could tip you off that you're talking to the protagonist of The Devil Wears Prada, then you lack a support structure in a fundamental way, I think.
Yeah. Okay, that's good to know.
That's what why I think Sophie is funny, and I are here, Robert.
What's funny about the way Lewis talks about this is that he marvels at this, right? Like, it's the most amazing thing, and it's evidence of how unique Sam is. When you just noted one of the biggest pieces of entertainment for millennials and Gen Z is people playing video games and explaining politics, right? It is not at all unique that Sam Bankman-Fried will not stop gaming to have a business meeting. But Michael Lewis treats it as like, this is evidence that he is too much of a genius. He can't bear to pay attention to her for a second. He also, there's a little bit of anti-woman stuff in here because Lewis notes Sam would minimize the window with her face on it whenever she spoke and bring it back up whenever he talked, right? Curiously, only when he was talking did he want to see her, which I do think there's a lot in that sentence.
Exhausting.
Yeah, it is. Again, like the way Lewis describes this isn't just, he's not very disciplined and he has the same thing that like a lot of millennial and Gen Z people have, which is, you know, an inability to stop distracting yourself no matter what important shit you're doing. He describes this as SBF's brain being so big that like games are, he's like a Sherlock Holmes character and games are his heroine, right?
Well, that like, makes me, that indicates to me that Michael Lewis, because that's the way that you're, like your doting parent would talk about you. And like, that's that is clear to me. The way he sees him is like, wow, look at this amazing kid. And also what SBF is doing here is like the inverse of what most easily distracted millennial and Gen Z people are doing. When they're playing games and explaining radical politics to you. They're not playing games and talking to some like half listening to someone before they part with millions of dollars to throw the world's stupidest annual party.
Yeah.
And I love that stupid ass party.
It's. I mean, I think both of those things are on a similar level potentially, but it depends on how you do them. And he's not actually good at it. But the way Lewis describes this is he just is in awe of this kid's ability to have attention deficit disorder. Quote, "Yeah, absolutely," said Sam. But his mind was elsewhere. The horde dragon was dead. Anna Wintour had killed it. What to do? He made a half-hearted bid to begin another game and pick another hero, but then changed his mind and shut the game down. He could often occupy two worlds at once and win in both. In this case, he clearly stood no chance of winning in one world unless he paid less attention in the other, and this woman somehow had acquired a spell that interfered with his abilities to multitask. What an amazing way to write that paragraph, Michael Lewis.
Dude.
Oh, God. It's something else. Like, I have played video games through some important work meetings. Sophie has often had to pick my ass up off that. It's not because I'm a genius. It's because I'm hungover and have trouble focusing because I use Twitter too much.
There's so many. I mean, whatever. And also you have to imagine that this manuscript made it through a lot. It speaks to how old people mm-hmm. in general who work in the publishing industry are, that no one was like, Michael, I hate to tell you that this is just how kids are these days.
He's a real venture game genius. Yeah.
It's like we've both written books. Like I was surprised that I got the title of my book through, but it was because people over 60 don't know what raw dog means.
No.
And so most of the people in publishing. Like, it's ridiculous. That's so nuts that made it to the final book.
No, so if you're not reading critically and inclined to give Lewis the benefit of the doubt, I can see how you might assume that, like, he's trying to make Sam look kind of silly in that paragraph. I can see how you would assume that based on the text, but that is not what's going on, listener. Here is Lewis talking about that exact same moment in an interview with Intelligence Squared from about a month ago.
Yay.
So on the screen, Zoom, Anna Wintour. And he does not know who she is. He doesn't know what the purpose of the meeting is. He doesn't know, the purpose of the meeting is, can Sam Bankman-Fried pay for the whole Met Gala? If that's the purpose of the meeting. Because he'll pay for everything else, why not that? And she comes on the screen and she is dressed to the nines. She's got those sighs of hair coming down around
that's
her
just
chin.
What she's like.
She's like ready to kill. And gorgeous. You know, she looks great. She's well prepared. He's playing Storybook Brawl, which is his video game.
Pause. I hate the way he talks about Anna Wintour. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Wow. Okay.
Okay.
We can deal with that in private. Sophie.
Before we can talk about a woman on a Zoom call, does she look gorgeous or does not?
That's the point. It says nothing to do with Anna Wintour. Also, she looks like that all the time. Thank you so much. It's her thing.
And whenever she comes on the screen, he blacks her out and the video game pops up. So like she's talking and minotaurs are killing dwarfs and trees with axes are coming in and weapons are appearing on the screen and people are dying and exploding and you're hearing her talk about the Met Gala. And there's 7 minutes in when he hits a button and the Wikipedia entry for the Met Gala comes up so he can figure out what the hell she's talking about. And he's doing, I watched him do this. He's doing this with her. This is what he was doing on live television when he would be interviewed by Bloomberg TV. It was like he had tricks. It took him about 1/10 of his brain to have a conversation with Anna Wintour. And what he would do, the other part of his brain was either reading about who she was or playing his game. And what he'd do is he'd say, you ask me a question. He'd say, that's a really good question. It's a really good question. Let me think about that for a minute. You know, meanwhile, the minotaur is killing the tree. And he comes off and then he thinks for a minute and he says some boilerplate thing.
So that does not show genius. He's obviously the smile on his face. That is not him being critical. That's him thinking about, like, that's him fawning over this kid for not being prepared for a multi-million-dollar meeting, right? Which is, like, fine, but that's not an example of him being smart.
I think that is a clear pattern in the way that we cover the, like, young white kid genius who comes from a rich background. There's a lot of similarities in how early Mark Zuckerberg's like casual misogyny and not giving a shit about people was like part and parcel to why he was cool and why he was seen as a visionary. Like that, the same is true. Like I feel like every generation has at least one of these guys and they're all covered in the same way. And no one ever learns their lesson because the guy covering them is often the same guy.
It's Michael Lewis.
That guy's dad.
Literally Michael Lewis.
Literally Michael Lewis. Yeah.
How did this resolve with Anna Wintour? Did she, like,
he says, yeah, I'll pay for it. And then he just ghosts her.
Yeah. So the fact that Anna Wintour didn't like smoke out that he was like fully a fraud. The girlies are disappointed.
I'm not caping for Anna Wintour here, but
named the Dragon Lady. Well, no.
SPF is lucky that he'll never encounter Bill Nighy because for Bill Nighy, it would be on site.
Oh, Bill Nighy would fuck him
up. It would be on site.
So
he was in I, Frankenstein, for crying. He was in Detective Pikachu.
Robert, in a lot
this
of great
episode
films.
Has broken like my those. Brain.
So
my brain
these are,
is broken.
These are amusing anecdotes, right? What he's telling, potentially, if you are someone who is critical about him, that same anecdote could form part of your thesis about why this kid got away with it and for so long and why he ultimately flamed out. But Lewis is convinced that these show you evidence of Sam's genius. And he sets this up early in the book, talking about Sam's childhood. Quote, he had a fault line inside him. Pressure was building on it. And one day, in the seventh grade, he slipped. His mother returned from work to find Sam alone, in despair. I came home and he was crying, recalled Barbara. He said, I'm so bored, I'm going to die. And, like, I have had a similar conversation with my mom, and it's a sign, you know, certainly Sam has been diagnosed with ADHD. That's certainly one way in which that can manifest.
I'm sorry. But, I'm sorry. Hold on. One for the girlies again. That is a direct quote from Sex and the City.
Oh, okay.
That is a direct quote from a Sex and the City episode.
Sure. I'm sure Sam's a big Samantha head.
Wait, who says it?
She goes, I'm so bored I could die, and she jumps out of, and she falls out of the window.
Oh my god, this is literally one of the most famous moments in the back half of Sex and the City. Wow.
Yeah.
I don't remember that. Anyway, so because, like, Lewis, again, if you're just kind of being honest about Sam and writing a book, you might be like, well, Sam gets diagnosed with ADHD. This moment makes total sense as like, yeah, this is a kid who's got ADHD and he's also, you know, good at math and stuff. He's bored in the classes that he's in. But Lewis does not acknowledge that Sam has ADHD in his book. He doesn't say anything about it because that's not a bad thing, obviously. But no. It's also that you're not a genius just because you have ADHD, right? Plenty of people who are not super geniuses have ADHD. It's just a thing.
And it's like if you're talking about that behavior, and I want to be like delicate in the way I talk about it, but it's like it's contextually important.
Mm-hmm. If you proceed from the principle, like, yeah, this is a kid with ADHD, then there's another explanation for his addiction to games, his inability to focus on stuff, right? And then it means those things aren't a sign of his brilliance, right? Now, part of why I'm critical of Michael for this is that he does make a note about one character's ADHD in the book. And it's Carolyn Ellison, who comes across as one of the villains in the book. And I should note that the following paragraph comes from a part of the book where Lewis is talking to George, who is a therapist who worked for FTX as the company shrink. So, among other things, this is a therapist talking about his patient, right?
Okay.
When she'd first come to him back in 2018, she'd had two issues she wanted to talk about: her attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and her new and emotionally complicated polyamorous lifestyle. Every subsequent session after the first, Carolyn came back with just one issue she wanted to discuss: Sam. She'd fallen in love with Sam. Sam didn't love her back, and that fact alone left her deeply unhappy. I thought of her as an exception, said George. I thought she might be willing to trade effective altruism for reciprocation of love any day. Right?
Sorry, how is it like, I mean, I truly, like, how is it even legal or ethical for this information to be
I don't actually
out
know.
There?
I don't
like,
actually
that
know,
truly,
Jamie.
It's
that
like,
does seem sketchy to me.
Therapists are not supposed to be able to do, like, they're famously not supposed to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. And also, not to, like, overly come to her defense, but also, it's like, if anyone's therapy logs were leaked, it would be like, they had this fixation on this issue. Well, yeah, that's why you fucking go, dude. You don't go there to be a reasoned person.
No, and especially since, like, what's messy to me is that he makes sure to bring this up with Carolyn because he's kind of writing that, like, she was unreliable, she wasn't focusing enough, she was in love with him.
She was being hysterical, perhaps.
Whereas he's just this misunderstood genius, but he notes her ADHD and he doesn't note Sam's, even though Sam's ADHD is a matter of public fucking record now. Like, his family went to court to get him his medicine.
Well, it's like, and it's
like,
not
this
even
is not a hidden thing.
It's like not even something that he particularly tries to obscure, right?
No. And again, it's critical to understand him because it provides an alternate explanation for all this behavior that Lewis chalks up to him just like only needing 10% of his brain to talk to people.
Yeah.
Now, there's another very fun bit in this, which kind of relates to that, which is that, and this is like the weirdest through line in Going Infinite, which is Michael Lewis does not understand games. Right? Like, he writes about, like, video games and board games and other popular nerd pastimes that are now, like, the dominant form of entertainment by money in our country. He talks about them like he's an alien who's just arrived on the planet. And as a result, he talks about Sam's embrace of this stuff at the expense of everything else to be evidence of brilliance. Quote, He felt nothing in the presence of art. He found religion absurd. He thought both right-wing and left-wing political opinions kind of dumb, less a consequence of thought than of their holder's tribal identity. He and his family ignored the rituals that punctuated most people's existence. He didn't even celebrate his own birthday. What gave pleasure and solace and a sense of belonging to others left Sam cold. When the Bankman-Frieds traveled to Europe, Sam realized that he was just staring at a lot of old buildings for no particular reason. We did a few trips, he said. I basically hated it. To his unrelenting alienation, there was only one exception. Games. In sixth grade, Sam learned about a game called Magic the Gathering. For the next 4 years, it was the only activity that consumed him faster than he could consume it. And this is so funny because, like, Lewis has to describe Magic the Gathering after this point. And he, like, he describes it basically... It's the first game ever made where, like, you, like, the way that you play it, like, it's different. Like, every character can come into this strategy game with a different set of equipment. No one had ever done this before. It was all like chess where everyone's the same. And it's like, no, it wasn't. There were decades of war games and strategy games that Magic was influenced by. Like, that's just wrong, now, Michael
hold
Lewis.
On. Now, hold
you
on,
didn't
nerd.
Google
hold on,
Magic.
Nerd.
Yeah.
Hold on, nerd. Any put a pin in that. I do think that, like, this is of the because I don't play Magic the Gathering, and I know that how he's describing it is wildly incorrect. I feel like
it's so wrong. Yeah,
I think that speaks more to like a generation gap.
Yeah.
Because I think there's someone who could be on the opposite side of SPF and equally with it. Like, it's just like, do your research. Just talk to someone who plays Magic the Gathering. They famously love to talk about it.
And it's funny because he's like, he has to make this, like, he goes in on a limb about, like, Sam Bankman-Fried didn't like chess. It was too boring. There were too few possibilities. Like, you could calculate his computer brain wasn't amused by chess. Oh, only
magic possibility wasn't enough for him.
Yeah, it's so funny. God. It's like, man, my friends and I all played Magic the Gathering. And, like, as a spoiler, some people looked into Sam's, like, performance in League of Legends and the other online. He was never good at anything. He was not very good. He wasn't particularly bad, but he was not very good. And I'm going to guess he was indifferent at Magic the Gathering because it's a wonderful game, not a great, like, yardstick for your intelligence. You know,
it's just a card game. Like, no one should be, no one should be judged by their intelligence by how they interact with, like, a beloved hobby. That's weird.
Yeah, it's so weird. And it's, like, it's interesting because, like, Sam's parents, a big part of this section is, like, he comes home and he's like, I'm so bored. I want to die. And his parents do what I think is the right thing. They lead the charge to get their school to add, like, an advanced math class. And it seems to have a good impact on him. He's excited to go to school now. And that's a good thing. But what we find hints of in parts of this story, and I don't think Lewis is able, either knows it or is able to admit it to himself, is the troubling fact that once Sam's parents decide he's a math genius, they don't bother to make him into a well-rounded person. Sam grows up hating art. He thinks books are useless. He has this big rant he goes about, like, well, there's no way that Shakespeare's the best author ever because there have been this many billion people born since he was alive. And if you want to calculate the odds that none of them were better at writing than him, then there's really no reason to read Shakespeare. And it's like, well, Sam, the fact that you think that means that, like, no one even casually tried to teach you the humanities, because, like, the reason you should study Shakespeare is not that he's the quote unquote best author ever. That doesn't exist. It's that there is not a day in your life or the life of anyone that you love that they don't use words and phrases Shakespeare introduced to the English language. That's why he's important.
And don't get me wrong, Sam, I also don't want to read a book, but sometimes
just what you need to do to understand the world and not go to prison for forever because you're a gambler.
Or just be willing to fucking Google your way around it. Like, you're not better than Shakespeare, you fucking weirdo. There is, like, an element of, like, there are certain, the lower side of SBF L's that he takes in the statements he makes. He sounds like a one episode Frasier character.
Yes.
You know,
he sounds
like Freddie made a friend and he fucking sucks. And
yeah, he's a
SBF.
Piece of shit.
Yeah, and then he even polarizes Frasier and Niles, and that's how you know you're in fucking trouble.
Yeah, Yeah. When Niles is like, this kid's kind of got a fucking problem.
This kid's incomprehensible. Yeah. I wouldn't share a glass of brandy with him.
Yeah. And man, if you know Niles, you know what that takes. Hey, everyone. Robert here. Just wanted a quick note that the last 5 or 6 minutes of this episode is all Frasier. It's all Frasier talk. Jamie and I got off on a tangent. There is a lot more Sam Bankman-Fried in part two. It's another like hour and 20 minutes. So plenty more on Thursday. But as a heads up, in case it's kind of confusing, we just wound up in a Frasier hole after this point. So if you want to hear us talk about Frasier, this is your chance. Speaking of David Hyde Pierce, Jamie Loftus,
yes.
You are starring in a floor show with David Hyde Pierce.
I sure am.
Based on the life of Kelsey Grammer, actually. You are playing Kelsey. You spent, like Michael Lewis, a full year living with him to really get his character down. What was that like?
Yeah. Look, it was pretty hostile. It was pretty hostile. And in the subsequent publishings that I've made, a lot of people have said that I couldn't explain the video games that Kelsey Grammer was playing for the year that I was following him around. And I resent that. I was in the room with Kelsey while he was berating women on the phone. And I think that makes him a genius. I think that makes him a genius. And, you know, do I believe he's the greatest sitcom actor of all time? Well, I'll keep that to myself, but wink, wink. I think that he's kind of a beautiful genius and is above criticism. And if you don't think that he's kind of the perfect person, or if you even like just read his Wikipedia page and form an opinion, I beg to disagree. And
I love Kelsey Grammer stories from the height of Frasier, because they're all members of the cast being like, well, yeah, he was very like, he came on set and he had clearly just woken up after vomiting up his 7 martini lunch. He looked like he was dying. We were all worried that he was going to drop dead that day. And then the director called action and he was immediately in character.
He was
and
Frasier.
Did the whole, he was perfect.
He was beautiful. His chest hair perked. Yeah. Like, we'll never know. Mm-hmm. I was fixated on Frasier reruns when I was a kid. I would stay up late to watch them.
Yeah, it's one of my comfort shows for sure. Yeah.
The best. And like when I remember getting Kelsey Grammer's like memoir from the library and read that he broke up with his wife on the phone. And it may have been one of the first times that I was like, wow. Men are scary. Yes. Like you can just do that. You could just be Kelsey Grammer and be evil, and I will still like base my sexuality on you forever.
Sure, absolutely.
Doesn't seem fair.
Whomst among us, right?
I know.
Oh man, but I will say, having watched the new Frasier show, it becomes very clear how much of that show's charm was John Mahoney and David Hyde Pierce.
I think Kelsey's doing, I mean, and he's an evil person. He's doing his damn best.
He is perfect. He is like literally his voice has not changed in 20 years, which is remarkable.
No. And he's been, you know, physically preserved well enough.
Yes. Yeah. One of the big problems that show has is they've cast that kid as Niles and Daphne's son, and they're relying on him to hold up a lot of the physical comedy end that David Hyde Pierce used to. And if you are going up next to David Hyde Pierce in like a physical comedy competition, you're gonna look like
good
shit.
Fucking luck, my
he's
man.
David
good
Hyde Pierce.
Fucking luck. Yeah. He's the guy. Robert, I thought you would love the Frasier reboot because it's some of the most abysmal Boston accents I've ever heard in my fucking life.
Don't get me wrong. I've watched every episode, Jamie.
Some of the nastiest little I have to like pause sometimes and like get a glass of water.
Really? Yeah.
I have to like walk off some of the accents.
Yeah.
I mean, you have I have conceded long ago that you've got it down.
Thank you. Well, anything to plug, Jamie, after our 5-minute Frasier digression?
Yeah. Well, I'd like to plug the Frasier reboot because I would like a second season.
Yeah. Check it out, everybody. It's not shit.
It's on Paramount Plus. I also just read Raw Dog and follow me online if you're so inclined. And that's all I have to say. Listen to the Bechdel cast while you're at it. Why not?
Yeah. All right.
What about you?
That's it. I'm done.
You're
go
done.
Figure out where David Hyde Pierce lives, you know?
Don't
send
do
him
that.
A letter.
Bye.
Send him a nice letter.
I wonder if I can walk there. Bye.
Yeah, you might be able to. Let Jamie know.
Behind the Bastards is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.